Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God?
Chief Justice John Roberts of the Supreme Court yesterday swearing in all 100 of the U.S. senators to serve as the jury in the impeachment trial of President Trump. That trial gets underway Tuesday, the day after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It begins at 10 o'clock our time, and we'll be bringing you NPR's live gavel-to-gavel coverage. And I'm sure one of the analysts who will be a part of that coverage over the course of the weeks to come is the senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, Ron Elving. Ron, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
You're going to be a very busy man over these coming weeks, I know. But first of all, let's just sort of update where we're at. What do we expect to happen on day one?
We expect the managers to lay out the case. We also could get a vote right away, but it's more likely to come a little later with regard to whether there are going to be witnesses. And that is, of course, the great question hanging over this trial at this moment. The Democrats would very much like to call some of the people they think have pertinent information, people who were present for some of the decision-making and the discussion of those decisions, and who could shed a lot of light on what the president thought he was doing and what, in fact, the law would be with respect to the president's moves. That would, of course, start with former National Security Advisor John Bolton, might also involve people such as the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and on down the list of people who were involved in the relationship between the president and Ukraine.
Is there any appetite to call Lev Parnas, who for the past couple of nights has been with Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, since given an interview on CNN as well, where he's made the allegation that President Trump was centrally involved in the effort to try and get the Ukrainian government to announce an investigation of the Bidens?
There is certainly a lot of appetite for that among some Democrats, and certainly a lot of appetite in the media, because it would make quite a show. But at the same time, we don't really expect these people to come to the well of the Senate. It would be much more likely they would follow the precedent of the Clinton impeachment from 21 years ago this winter, when they brought in video screens and showed the depositions of these various witnesses that had been previously taken and videotaped. That's a much greater likelihood. And I'm guessing at this point that because Parnas would not be considered to be a firsthand witness for some of this, that he might not be high on the list. And certainly the president, who says he has no idea who this person is, despite the photographs of them together, and one suspects the Republicans supporting the president in the Senate would object.
And I have to say, in terms of the photograph, for people who are in public life like that, they do take photos with people that they don't really know who they are. So he may very well, the president may very well know who Lev Parnas is and have had, one-on-one or small group conversations with him or not. The photo, to me, doesn't necessarily prove that one way or the other.
I agree. It doesn't prove that the president knows him or remembers why he was having his picture taken with him. But the other people in the picture also do provide the bridge between the president and Lev Parnas and some of his other associates. And we are told, at least in many of these accounts, that some of these encounters were not unique. And certainly Rudy Giuliani's contact with the president and with Mr. Parnas was not limited. Even though the photographs are not evidence, what they do is they serve on television to create a certain impression. And the president knows that better than anyone else.
We're talking with Ron Elving of NPR, and we had such wonderful response when Ron came on to answer listener questions during the House impeachment hearings that we're doing the same here on the cusp of the start of the Senate impeachment trial. This is your chance to ask questions about the impeachment trial with a caveat that there's a lot we don't know at this point. Tuesday, presumably, the Senate is going to detail more of the rules of the road for how the process will be unfolding over the coming weeks. Nonetheless, Ron has a tremendous amount of information to share, and he's very generously giving his time to talk with us. Please call at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. It's your opportunity to ask questions about the impeachment process of NPR's Ron Elving, who'll be providing analysis all along the way and reporting also. Ron, I wonder about Rudy Giuliani as the president's personal attorney. Because of attorney-client privilege, would that remove him altogether from potentially being called as a witness?
Not necessarily. What he could not be asked would be the same thing you couldn't ask a priest about somebody who came in and confessed to a crime. Somebody comes into a confessional situation, that's called the priest-penitent exception, and the priest cannot be compelled to tell you what he heard in confessional. That, however, does not mean that the priest could go down the street and commit some sort of a crime and have some sort of a relationship with that penitent person and have that be completely protected. So in this instance, you have Rudy Giuliani, who is the president's personal attorney. He cannot be questioned about anything that the two of them discussed in confidentiality. But his own activities, his own actions, the things he may have done in Ukraine and elsewhere, Those things are fair game. Even if he were doing it somehow on behalf of the president, they become his own actions when he's out there acting on his own.
Do you have a sense, Ron, whether there's been any movement on the part of Republican senators since the conclusion of the House hearings and where we are today? Because there have been the developments of the documents that Democrats released on Tuesday and Wednesday, I believe, that included Lev Parnas's attorney, the documents that he released. There have been other things there, the Parnas interviews, the governmental accountability office report yesterday morning that the president violated the law by withholding the security funding to Ukraine over policy matters. Has this, in your observation, affected the Republicans in the Senate at all?
Not by observation in the sense that you see somebody coming forward and saying, look, I'm taking all this much more seriously now, but there's all this new information. We're not hearing so much of that. What we have heard is several senators saying that they think that there's enough here and the desire to either exonerate the president or in some sense or another dishonor the impeachment process from the House, there's reason here to hear witnesses, that let's take it seriously. Let's do what we did with Bill Clinton and bring in the televisions and let's not make it a circus. Let's just hear from some of these people. And if we do it in some sort of closed door session, let's do it that way. But the point is to get all the information so we can make a reasoned judgment. We have a few Republicans saying that. And if four Republicans were willing to vote with the Democrats on compelling witnesses or admitting witnesses, that would change the game, because then Mitch McConnell could not say no. He could not say, we, the Republicans, are opposed. If there are 51 votes, there are 51 votes, and witnesses there will be.
We're talking with NPR senior editor Ron Elving as we prepare for Tuesday morning start of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. Again, your opportunity to ask any questions at all about the process, about the charges themselves, about what's contained in those charges, testimony that was presented before both the intelligence and the judiciary panels of the House, 866-893-KPCC. And a reminder that Tuesday, when we come back from MLK Day, AirTalk will be on at 9 o'clock, an hour earlier than usual. We will walk you right up to NPR's live gavel-to-gavel coverage of the trial starting at 10 o'clock. Once again, AirTalk will be on at 9, right after Morning Edition on Tuesday, and that may last for quite a while. We'll just have to see. We'll be back in just 2 minutes. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Yesterday, we were joined live by Congressman Adam Schiff, who's the lead prosecutor, manager, as the technical term is, for the House of Representatives as it presents its case against President Trump in the two articles of impeachment. Just before the congressman joined us live yesterday, he had this to say on the floor of the Senate.
In all of this, President Trump acted in a manner contrary to his trust as president and subversive of constitutional government, to the great prejudice of the cause of law and justice, and to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Wherefore, President Trump, by such conduct, has demonstrated that he will remain a threat to the Constitution if allowed to remain in office, and has acted in a manner grossly incompatible with self-governance and the rule of law. President Trump thus warrants impeachment and trial, removal from office, and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States.
That's Adam Schiff as he was introducing the articles of impeachment on the floor of the U.S. Senate yesterday. And I don't know whether we'll have any access to him during the course of the trial. He'll obviously be very busy, but he's gone out of his way to make himself available. I'm a little unhappy with President Trump for adding to his legal team Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz, two supporters of the president's legal position we've called on this program to use as guests, and now they're going to be part of the president's legal team. My tongue's in cheek, but unfortunately, those two that we have used will not be available because they'll be part of the president's defense team. We're taking your questions for Ron Elving at 866-893-KPCC, NPR senior editor. Let's talk with Bill in Marina Del Rey. Bill, your question for Ron.
Right. I don't understand how it is that Nancy left out all these other charges, the 10 by Mueller, the emoluments clause. Like, they are an integral part of an impeachment, and she just left it out. I don't understand her thinking.
All right, Ron, why were the two specific charges of impeachment from the House, the ones that they chose versus the things Bill mentions?
That has been a major area of debate among the Democrats for many months, and of course focusing on the two articles that they did bring forward since the hearings in the fall and the debate and the vote in the House of Representatives. The thinking was this, and you can decide how compelling you find it, but the thinking was that if the House had not moved to impeach the president over emoluments up until this summer or fall, if they hadn't moved on Robert Mueller's 10 instances of what might be viewed as obstruction of justice back in Volume 2 of Robert Mueller's report that came out last April, that if they hadn't moved on them then, why were they bringing them up now? And what the difference was, clearly, in the minds of the leaders of the House, was this egregious challenge to the rule of law and to the authority of Congress that's represented by the president holding up nearly $400 million in aid that had been properly appropriated by the Congress in a law and signed into law by the president, and which then must flow or he is breaking the law. Why was he to be allowed to just stop it in order to prompt some sort of political favor from the leaders of Ukraine? That could not be brooked. The challenge of that was so much greater in degree than all the other things that had been discussed up to that point. So then the question becomes, why not throw in all the rest of it? Why not throw in the kitchen sink? Why not throw in the boilerplate? And I think that the answer was keep the focus on what could be more clearly demonstrated and what had been learned from the whistleblower this summer and what the public could understand was a new development and something specific that could be specifically charged. Many times in the past, fairly notorious criminals have gone off to prison on one charge, despite the fact that the prosecutors might have had some evidence of many other crimes. And they thought it best to prosecute them on what they considered the best part of their case.
We have a listener, let's see, I believe it's Ian in North Hollywood, who wonders, how does yesterday morning's release of the report from the Governmental Accountability Office factor into the trial? Does it factor into the trial?
It does not make any kind of sea change in the trial, because the Democrats have been alleging all along that the president broke the law. So to have a government agency come along and say, yes, the president broke the law, and he may have done it even sooner than you realized, is clearly corroborative. It's clearly a support for them. It's clearly an affirmation of the Democrats' case against the president, of the manager's case. And so, in that sense, it's clearly a great help. Here we are talking about yet another sheriff coming to town and saying, I just found a guy breaking the law and his name is Donald Trump. So every time that happens, we get a convention of these people together, it looks stronger. Now, does it turn a lot of Republicans around overnight? No, it doesn't. They will probably come up with a way to say, well, the GAO is mistaken. Yes, this is a trusted, nonpartisan element of the government that people rely on every day and which is rigorously kept away from the politics of Congress in Washington as much as that is physically possible or humanly possible. Yes, that's all true, but we just aren't going to change our minds until we have a more political determination that that's what we should do.
And I had to say for myself, when I read what the GAO office said, my first thought, and I hadn't seen Republican response or anything, was, well, during the Obama administration, of course, when Vice President Joe Biden was the point person in negotiations with Ukraine, they withheld some money to try and get the widely considered corrupt prosecutor removed, and that was leveraged. And I understand the argument is that was on behalf of U.S. interests and allies' interests as opposed to personal political interest for something that would benefit President Obama. But nonetheless, it is a policy effort that's entailed. So I was wondering about that language in the GAO report, if that is in fact true, that you can't withhold money that Congress has approved for a specific purpose like this for to further a policy. I wonder if that would apply to what the Obama administration did.
I believe that I'm probably not the best person to try to answer that particular legal question, but I believe that another difference here is that this was in pursuit of the policy for which that is to say, in the case of what Biden was saying, that he was withholding the money in pursuit of the policy for which that money had been appropriated. In this instance, that is not the case. So there is that.
Okay.
Important distinction, but there would probably be more to that answer from a person who is more legally adept at defining the difference.
Ron, I just appreciate your expertise because you know more than about anybody I know on this. So thank you. I appreciate it. Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent, NPR's Washington desk. I have more listener questions asking Ron. Next up, we'll talk about the role of Chief Justice John Roberts. How much latitude does he have, if at all, when it comes to the proceedings starting on Tuesday? You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Coming up on Film Week, yes, we do need a break from politics. As important as the impeachment process is, we're going to spend an hour on movies, as we always do. Fridays at 11 coming up, our critics review Bad Boys for Life, the third in the Bad Boys trilogy. Will Smith and Martin Lawrence reteam in the action comedy. Also, there's a new version of Dr. Doolittle, this time starring Robert Downey Jr. And we'll talk about Troop Zero, starring Viola Davis, who's always great in everything she's in. That's coming up on Film Week. We'll also talk with an intimacy coordinator who works actually on the set as sex scenes are being filmed to make sure that actors are protected, that they're able to speak their mind about things they're uncomfortable with, and to also help choreograph those scenes. We'll talk with the intimacy coordinators, worked on a number of major projects, joins us also during Film Week today. Right now, Ron Elving, senior editor, correspondent on NPR's Washington desk, joining us to talk about the impeachment trial of President Trump, which begins at 10 o'clock Tuesday morning after an hour of air talk. We hit the air an hour earlier than typically, 9 o'clock right out of Morning Edition. We'll take you up all the way to NPR's live gavel-to-gavel coverage. James in Encino says the president made a mistake in that phone call with the president of Ukraine, but the president was a businessman before. He doesn't necessarily understand what's legal or what's not. Shouldn't someone on the White House staff have told him doing that was wrong? And if they didn't, shouldn't they be held responsible? Ron?
We don't know whether someone on the president's staff had told him not to hold up this aid. The GAO report is interesting because it indicates that this activity to hold up this aid had been underway before that telephone call that has become so famous. And there were other people on the phone call at the time. We don't know what counsel they may have given to the president. We do know that John Bolton in September left his job in part, at least, because of his disagreement with the president's handling of this situation, and particularly his unhappiness with having Rudy Giuliani be a backdoor agent moving around the world representing the president as his personal attorney when the Secretary of State or the National Security Advisor thought it was their job to represent the United States overseas. So there is the prospect, the very real prospect, that the president had been advised that this money was properly appropriated and needed to be flowing. There seems to have been no problem from the Pentagon with it, and question marks did seem to have popped up here and there in May and June as to why the aid was not flowing when it had been promised and appropriated and signed into law.
We have a couple of listeners who want to ask about the role of Chief Justice John Roberts, because the senators we know are the jury, and they're the judge too, aren't they?
In a very real sense, they are. In a very real sense, the entire Senate is convened as a court. And we sometimes call them jurors because they're being asked to render a kind of guilty or not guilty verdict, and that's a juror's job. But they actually have the status, and in a very real sense, of being judges as well. And Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, is really there to preside in the absence of the usual presiding officer of the Senate. Now, this is not to say that the usual officer is there every day, but when in big ceremonial occasions you want the presiding officer there, it's supposed to be Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States. And the Constitution anticipated the rather conflicted position that a vice president would be in, presiding over the trial of the current president and perhaps removing him, in which case that vice president would become president. So in recognition of that conflict, they specified the Chief Justice should come and take the place. But he doesn't actually make a lot of rulings. When Chief Justice Rehnquist did it for the Clinton trial, he said, "I did very little and I did it very well."
And one of the questions was about whether the Chief Justice could weigh in on the calling of witnesses, but that would be a decision for the full Senate?
That's right. And one question that has emerged, and this is perhaps a little less clear, is can he break a tie? Normally, if there's a 50-50 tie in the Senate, the vice president, as the presiding officer, Mike Pence in this case, breaks that tie, and he has done that on occasion. So who's going to break that tie if there's a 50-50 tie on a procedural question such as calling witnesses? One person that might look like he's in a position to do it would be the Chief Justice. Now, that question didn't arise in the Clinton case. Way back in Andrew Johnson's case in 1868, the Supreme Court's Chief Justice at that time was presented with three ties. Two times he chose to break the tie, and on the third time he recused himself, and that is now considered to be the reigning precedent or the latest precedent in terms of whether or not the Chief Justice should weigh in and break a tie.
We're talking with Ron Elving of NPR. Ron, what do you anticipate will be this now expanded defense team of the president's, their working strategy?
Primarily to take each piece of the manager's case and take it apart, dissect it, suggest that it isn't strong enough to reach a conclusion. And they'll leave the more political question of whether or not guilty or not guilty is is, well, let's put it this way. There's a political question, even if you think the president did everything he's accused of. The question then becomes, is it okay? Is it okay because we just want him to be president? And politically speaking, we don't think this rises to the level that would necessitate removing him from office. So we're not saying it's okay. We're not saying we're fine with it. We're just saying it's not impeachable. And that is a political judgment. That is not something that these lawyers are probably going to want to make a case for. They're much more likely going to make the case for the president being not guilty.
Maurice in West Hollywood messaged us on the AirTalk Facebook page. He said, I still don't understand, if no one's above the law, how is it legal for the president to not hand over documents and to forbid witnesses from testifying and therefore hiding possibly incriminating evidence? This is so interesting, Ron. We're getting a little short on time, but you know, the argument of defenders of the president that I've heard consistently is that this is the job of the courts, that a president is well within his latitude to not hand over certain documents, to not cooperate. They cite examples of President Obama in the Fast and the Furious gun case, not cooperating with Congress on certain things, and that the court decides. But Adam Schiff, in our conversation yesterday, made it very clear that that is obstruction in his view, and that the president is compelled in the separation of powers to fully cooperate. You have a quick thought on this?
Quick thought is that it has been adjudicated before, and usually people take the time to go to the courts to ask them what they think in this case. That's what finally drove Richard Nixon from office when the Supreme Court ruled against him, and he had to give up the tapes, and then he resigned. That's the Watergate case back in 1974. If there were going to be a rapid disposition, then the managers might have stepped back, but they saw the move to the courts as being 6 months, 8 months, 9 months before anything further would happen. There was no indication the courts were willing to expedite. And so rather than leave the president in what they consider to be an extra constitutional and violating of the Constitution mode, they decided to move ahead now.
Ron, it's such a pleasure. I know how busy you are. At least I think I have a sense. Thank you for joining us. We'll look forward to hearing you. Do you know if you're on Tuesday's NPR coverage?
We're still working on the schedule, but okay. I'll very well be. It's always a pleasure, Larry.
Thank you so much. You'll be hearing him a lot, Ron Elving of NPR News. Once again, the coverage begins gavel to gavel, 10 o'clock Tuesday morning live here on KPCC and AirTalk from 9 to 10 leading into it. We're off Monday for King Day, although we have our special interview with NPR Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep that re-airs in the 10 o'clock hour. Hey, I want to thank our tremendous AirTalk production team. Again, this year, this week, they knocked it out of the park. Yeah, this year, too. They're led by Fiona Ng, our senior producer. Our producers are Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, Natalie Chudnovsky, and Lindsay Wright. Emily Henderson helped us this week. Our news apprentices, Sabrina Fang and Julia Murray, and Parker McDaniels, our terrific engineer. Film Week is next.